Hello and welcome to episode 43 of the First and Goal podcast. I am Ben Roberts, joined by Sim Langa, and we have another special guest with us here. Pleased to be joined by Dustin Schutte of SI. Dustin, thank you for joining us. How are you doing this evening?
I'm doing great, guys. I appreciate you having me on.
Thanks for showing up, man. Appreciate it. Appreciate having you on.
So let's kind of dive right into it, as kind of a lot has been happening around the program recently. But I wanted to touch on first, and we talked about it on the last pod, and I gave all the listeners homework and told them to, if they don't do anything else, to make sure to check out the story that you wrote a couple weeks back about changing the rules for the College Football Hall of Fame to get Joe Tiller in. And I think it's a really good idea. I honestly, like, the thought never really crossed my mind. And then reading that, I was like, man, that makes so much sense. Like, how has there not been more movement there? So just kind of wanted to start, like, after writing it, has there been kind of some movement to kind of get that going at all, or kind of what's been the response since that?
Yeah, I think what the response has been a lot of Purdue fans that have it's probably not gonna get any traction from a national level or like an actual difference-making level, right? But I think a lot of Purdue fans are coming from the same spot you were, Ben, where it's like we didn't really think about it, but it would make sense for him to get in. And to, provide some background, the College Football Hall of Fame, the win percentage to get into the Hall of Fame, it was at 0.600. So 60% winning percentage. And they're going to move it back to 0.595, what they're going to call the Mike Leach rule, because unfortunately, during his time at Mississippi State, he passed away. He fell just short of meeting those qualifications. So this is a way to get him in and kind of honor him. And the 0.600 win percentage has always been a little silly to me in general. And when you look at what Joe Tiller did at Purdue, his winning percentage at Purdue and Wyoming was 0.575. And I know that this is part of it and you can pick and choose. But if you took away his final year at Purdue, it's 4-8. He was 0.585. He had a 0.585 winning percentage, if I remember the math correctly on that. And what really kind of stood out to me, and the comparison I'll make on this podcast is, and I made in the story as well, Joe Tiller took over a program that had been floundering in the Big Ten for 2 decades. They hadn't made a bowl game. I think it was one bowl game in the last 16 seasons, 0 bowl games in the previous 13 years he had been there. My argument is he took a program that was struggling and completely turned it around. And not only that, he revolutionized the way offense was played in the Big Ten. He brought in that spread offense and he changed the game. And I don't know that he gets enough credit. Like Mike Leach gets a lot of credit for kind of changing and altering the game. Urban Meyer gets a lot of that credit. But you don't hear Joe Tiller's name yet. When you go back and you talk to some of those coaches, you talk to Urban Meyer, you talk to Mark D'Antonio, Pat Fitzgerald. They always talk about how Joe Tiller revolutionized the Big Ten, how he changed the way offenses were played, and how much defenses had to change their game plan. And it just makes you wonder, like, Ryan Day is a really good football coach, right? Like, nobody's going to deny that. He just won a national championship at Ohio State. He's been in the college football playoff. He's won some Big Ten championships. But Ohio State's in a pretty good situation. I don't want to say it's pretty easy. It's a little easier to win games when you have all the five-star talent, a lot of four-star talent. So it's going to be a no-brainer that Ryan Day is going to get into the College Football Hall of Fame. But for a guy like Joe Tiller, who was loyal to Purdue, a place where it's harder to recruit, where you don't have those resources, to me, it's a really hard fight for those guys to try to get in just based on the win percentage. Like, let's look at it in totality. And
Right.
it's not like I'm pounding the door for a guy who had a 0.485 winning percentage. I'm talking about a guy who was pretty close to that 0.600. So I understand why there would be a winning percentage because you don't want to just let anybody in. It's supposed to be the Hall of Fame. But for a guy who led Purdue to a Big Ten championship, their first since 1967, got him to the Rose Bowl, who is known to have brought the basketball on grass style, I think it was somewhere, I'd have to do the math again on this. I don't remember what the number was of, but quite a few NFL prospects that he was able to develop, NFL draft picks. I just think that's deserving of a spot in the Hall of Fame.
Yeah, no, I agree. I like with Ben, I didn't know that there was, I didn't know that there was like a win percentage qualification, but I think you bring up a good point in terms of, because you hear this when like when the coaching hiring cycles come up about what are the most desirable jobs, and you look at a job like in Ohio State or, you know, really most of the jobs like in the SEC. Those ones are more desirable because, you know, from a resource standpoint, historically, like getting in there and being able to have more of that instant impact is going to be a lot easier. So in terms of where your starting point is, like you might not have that first like 3-9 or 4-8 season that you have to go through before you start getting to a 9-10 win season. So yeah, I think when you when I think if you if you're factoring that in terms of like those are I think those are some of the details that based on what I was reading from your article and as I've kind of thought about it more myself, I feel like that's some of the stuff that's not getting taken into consideration that should be. Because yeah, you do have to consider, okay, well, where was this program at when, you know, when Joe Tiller took over? And as you said, they were floundering at the bottom of the Big Ten, and now all of a sudden he brings them into prominence. And like you said, the term basketball on grass literally is tied to Joe Tiller. So, and like you said, the coaches who are for sure going to get into the Hall of Fame, you know, like you see them mention Joe Tiller in terms of his influence on the game. So yeah, I just yeah, that your article was really like was really informative for me because I wasn't really aware to it like that, and I didn't really honestly I didn't even realize like oh like wait he doesn't even have an opportunity to get in as it currently shakes out just based on the win percentage. And I think you also mentioned a good point of like he's not far away from there. He's just shy of it. So it's not like we're asking for an exception in the sense of like, well, because he's near and dear, we're being some type of bias. It's like, no, like look at the credentials and he's actually pretty close. It's not asking for a major stretch, you know, to allow a guy like Tiller to be able to be eligible.
Right. And to me, the thing, like, I would go through the percentage or I would go through the list of qualifications and through the list of accomplishments before I looked at that winning percentage. So to me, it should be like that squiggly line that dictates approximately. I'm not a
Right.
math wizard. I don't know what that squiggly line is actually called, right? But
Right.
just put that in front of the points. If you're around that number and you've had an impact on the game, because he took Purdue to, again, a team that hadn't been to a bowl game to 8 straight bowls, one of those being the Rose Bowl. He had big wins. Like, he was a nightmare at home, I should say, for Ohio State. Like, he won some major games. He brought Purdue back to national relevance. And I think not only the thing, not only what he accomplished before, but then you look at what they did afterwards. They weren't very good afterwards. Like, Danny Hope took him to 2 bowl games, and I don't think he had the resources. That's a different conversation, different story. And then Daryl Hazel comes in and Purdue's right back at the bottom. So you look at the what I think was 8 years after. So the 13 to 16 years before, and then the 8 years after, it's Purdue is not an easy place to win. And so not only to win there and to win at the level he did, to produce a player like Drew Brees, who was a Heisman Trophy finalist, to Kyle Orton, you want to throw him into the mix there too. He was that 2004 season. He was in the Heisman conversation for the first, gosh, I don't know, 7 games, maybe 7, 8 games of the season.
That
So
Wisconsin
when you,
game. I have that. I knew you were gonna mention it. I knew you were, and I was like, yep.
I was at that game. It was a brutal time,
That's rough. Yeah.
but I just think
Everybody
his
agree.
impact far outweighs the winning percentage and the impact he had, not just on the Big Ten, but on college football as a whole. And it's almost like he's being penalized for being loyal to Wyoming and then Purdue, because he could have probably gone. I mean, I'm sure he had offers. My journalism background doesn't date back quite that far, so I don't know, who might have tried to poach him or anything.
Right.
But who's to, if he goes to just throwing names out there, if he's to go to a Michigan or, a Clemson or something like that, who's to say that he doesn't have a higher winning percentage and gets in? So to me, that winning percentage, it doesn't account for those, as you mentioned, Sim, like if you have to go through a 3-9 season or a 4-8 season. So somebody who really goes through the building blocks of building a program,
Right.
they might be hurt because of that 0.600 winning percentage. So I understand why it's a qualification, but I would just say, look at everything they accomplished and then If it's close, or you're not like, then look at the winning percentage,
Right.
right? And if it's 50%, then maybe you say, okay, didn't really have the wins. But if it's 56, 57, maybe that guy deserves a spot in.
Right. No, I think to the point where you mentioned with like we having mentioned the article about like Breeze and Painter. I mean, yeah, Breeze, Curtis Painter, and then Kyle Orton and the guys, and then like even some receivers who are still to this day, when you look at the Big Ten records, they're there, sitting there in top five, top 10, top 20. They're sitting there, and again, those are all guys who played under Tiller. So yeah, I think that those are kind of points in his favor of like, look, like he wasn't just like, oh, a flash in the pot per se. It was like, no, like he was like the way his offense was and how good his teams were has withstood the test of time in terms of the records, especially I think offensively, when you're talking about passing and receiving with the way that the game has subsequently opened up so much, to see that that there are records there. I mean, there are stats there that from when he was there, you know, almost what 20 some years, almost 20 years ago now, to see that there's still stats there from players who played under him. Like, yeah, that shows, I guess, his impact and also just how good Purdue was while he was there.
And in an era and a time when that was not popular, that
Right.
was not like it was 3 yards. The Big Ten was 3 yards in a cloud of dust. Like
Yeah.
that old adage, that was what that conference was, and he opened it up. And so, as you said, now you play, everybody plays the way Purdue played, right? Like now that's the way offenses ran, and still those guys have those records. And it's just an incredible, to me, it's just an it speaks to the kind of impact he had on that program and on college football.
Everybody plays that way except for Iowa.
You know what? That's a good point, Ben. That's fair. Yeah.
That's very fair, man.
They
Iowa, and then
still
maybe
play three.
sometimes Wisconsin.
But no, yeah, I think it's just kind of really interesting. And you know, kudos to you for kind of shining a light on that. And I think it's a light that needs to be shined more on there. And kind of speaking in the same breath with that, recently, I think it was a few weeks back now, the for 2025, I believe the list came out, and Ryan Kerrigan is on that list. And he's another guy who I don't think is getting enough attention there. You know, there was some tweets I saw, and I think Ndamukong Suh was the one that he was being compared to pretty frequently. And you know, Ryan was a beast, man. He was a
A
game
monster,
changer on
man.
the defensive end. I still remember that game against Ohio State at home where he just owned Terrell Pryor. And you know, he's one too who I really hope he gets his flowers and gets in, and like you don't have to write a whole nother story about how he needs in too, because he's one man who I think was just underrated, even in the NFL was kind of underrated, as a defensive end, and a guy who I don't think is getting enough talk when that list came out.
Yeah, to your point, in the NFL, he was a four-time Pro Bowler, so he was successful even at that level. But yeah, I looked at, and it was immediately I looked at Ndamukong Suh, because I think it was somebody at On3 had put out a list of like the no-brainers on that list, and I thought, you know, let's just have some fun here. Let's look at the numbers, and Ryan Kerrigan's stats in a lot of those categories were better than Ndamukong Suh. Now, the important qualifier there is that Ndamukong Suh played defensive tackle, and
I was going to say, yeah,
Ryan
played defensive
Kerrigan
tackle
was
on the end.
and was a edge, right? So
Right.
the numbers, so it's a little bit easier for Kerrigan to
Yeah,
get
for Kerrigan.
sacks. I would argue that it may not be as easy for him to rack up those tackles for loss, but kind of depends on, you know, a lot of those sacks count into that. So, but yeah, he was one of the most dominant defensive players. I think it was after him when they wanted to start like referring to Purdue as the den of defensive ends on the defensive side. So you'd have the cradle of quarterbacks and the den of
Right.
defensive ends. So he was just another player that it was like, even when they weren't great, he was a guy that kept you in a football game. And that's a really hard thing to do for a defensive end. And he was, I think now when his college career ended, he led the NCAA in forced fumbles for a career. I think he's now third on that list, but to tally up 14, during his time is an impressive feat. And he was just, man, he was just always a guy that was defensive player of the year. And again, it's not like, I think he played on one 8-win team, so it wasn't like he played on the best Purdue teams that they've had. I know he was there for a couple Danny Hope years. I think he ended his career 4-8. So to be able to do what he did on some less than stellar Purdue football teams, I think was pretty impressive. And then, as you mentioned, Ben, he went to the NFL and did some good things there as well.
Yeah, he was a first round pick in the NFL too, wasn't he? Pretty sure he was.
I think so.
Yeah.
I think he was 16th overall, maybe, if I remember right.
Yeah, before Karl Loftus, it was definitely Kerrigan. Yeah, he was a wrecker. Like, he was definitely someone who you game plan for. Like, I imagine, like, you just couldn't let him get loose. And like you, as you said, Ben, that Ohio State game, he was BFS with Terrell Pryor by the end of the game, so.
That's the one that stands out, man. I think that
Right.
was kind of his statement game.
Right.
Dustin, kind of keeping along with the football theme, just kind of curious your thoughts, kind of football in general. I know it's probably hard. I mean, like, the whole roster is dang near brand new. So, like, you don't have to, like, really speak to any specific guys. I mean, probably literally the only guy I could tell you that I recognize was Ron Brown. But,
Remarkably.
like, well, I met guys that, like,
Oh,
new
that
guys, I guess I
right.
should
That's
say.
fair.
But Sam and I were talking a little bit on the last pod. We kind of went through the schedule, and I think the over under for the team right now is either a 3 or 3.5. And I'll admit I'm a full blown homer. And I think just kind of looking at the schedule, like, to me, that's almost worst case. Like, and I know it probably sounds weird. This is a team that won game last year, but, like, I think kind of they're in the 3 to 6 win range. With six being like, if everything goes right and they get everything to go their way, stay healthy, everything, I think they can make a bowl game. I think that's kind of like their ultimate ceiling, with the floor being right around 3 games. I know a lot can change from now till August, but kind of looking at them now, like, does that sound crazy? Like, I know the vibes seem really good right now. And, like, Sam and I were talking, like, obviously the vibes are good because they haven't played a game yet. So, like, there's nothing to be
Nothing to be down
upset
about,
about yet.
right?
But, it sounds kind of weird talking about a one-win team like that. But, like, I don't know, like, to me, that over seems kind of low.
I think it's a,
You're
I
gonna rain on
honestly
my
think it's a,
parade, huh?
I think it's honestly a fair, I'm gonna rain on
Rain
your
on it,
parade a little
rain
bit,
on it.
but then I'm
Okay.
also going to give you reasons why you should maybe feel validated in your argument. And so the first, I think 3.5 is a very fair number because I think the schedule is brutal. And so when you have a team that went 1-11 last season, and to me, the biggest thing is, it's almost 1-11 almost doesn't matter, because this is an entirely new team. This is a team that brought in 55 guys via transfer and I think 17 recruits. It's more than 70 total new faces on the roster. I know that. So last year is almost irrelevant. So to me, it's like, okay, I think if you were to ask me, are you going to bet over under 3.5? I would bet over, but simply because I think they'll win 4 games. I think they will win the first two of the season. And then I think they will beat Northwestern. So then you have basically some toss-up games there between Rutgers, Washington, maybe USC. You could throw that into the mix. And Minnesota plays a stinker, one or two of those every year. So maybe you catch them on a bad day. So I do think that they will win 4 games. The reason I'm not going to completely rain on the 6-win parade and a bowl game parade is because if you go back to 2016, that was a team that finished 2-10 or 3-9, I think maybe 2-10 under in
It
Darryl
was
Hazel's
bad.
last year.
Oh boy, that was
And
oh.
it came in and they had bad recruits. Jeff Brohm could not really assemble much of a recruiting class. He had to stick to the junior college ranks. And it was like, how are these guys going to win games? Like, this is going to be a rough first year. Turns out they go 7-6. They
Right.
play really well in that first game against Louisville, who had Lamar Jackson, which I covered that game. That was an incredible performance by Lamar Jackson. Like, that dude was that team. So you never know. Like, what does Barry Odom? I think there's just a lot of unknowns. And I've talked about this before too. Like, there doesn't seem to be a lot of hype around this team. And I think number one is because you just don't know anybody. You know Ryan Brown, you know Devin Mockabee. Maybe some people remember CJ Madden or Armand Branch. There's just not a lot of familiar faces. So what can you get excited about? Then you look at the schedule and nobody's really hyping you up. So this could be a similar to a 2017 where it's like, okay, Barry Odom, I do think what you're going to see is that sort of switch change from the way they were playing under Ryan Walters to Barry Odom, where even if they're not winning games, I think they're going to be competitive and I think they're going to be more fun to watch. And that's really the big key. Like I've said, all what are realistic expectations for Purdue football in 2025? If they can get to four wins and they're competitive and they're fun to watch and they're interesting, and you can say, hey, there are signs of life to this team, I think that's a huge improvement because this was a team that was getting beat 50 to nothing every single week. And it was just like, it was miserable to watch.
I was at that as the season took over. It was rough. It was rough out here. No, I agree. Ben and I actually talked about this last year, because that schedule, as we and that on paper, we knew like this is going to be, a tough road to trek. But our thing was like, it's okay if you're like if you're record wise, like if your record is like, let's just say like they ended up 3-9 last year, but there was you could like the in terms of the eye test, you were seeing like, hey, but they're able to do like they're they have this like this facet of the run game, or they have some talent here at the wide out. If they you had some tangible stuff from the eye test that was showing you like, yo, this is a competitive team, it was like, all right, cool, like that's how essentially at the time we were like, that's how Walters can probably save his job. It's just like you need to have a competitive product out there, something that we can all get behind. But when you're just getting just steamrolled every game, and that's kind of what like I thought about with like you said with Brohm's first year. And I remember at the end of the season, it might have been DJ Knox. Someone said they interviewed him and they interviewed one of the players, and they were like, all the work that they had them that they were doing in the summer, they were like, the Louisville game was the game where we knew, oh, like all of this actually, like this is paying off. Like we're better. And so I'm a strong believer that in the college game, effort can win you games that you're not supposed to win. So just like just playing up to your level and playing, being there from the moment the game starts, and like you catch a team like an Illinois or something like that who's just kind of off for a couple quarters. Now all of a sudden, boom, you're up on them, 24-10. You're there in the fourth. I that's how I can see a path of like you said with that same with Brohm's first team where there weren't a lot of expectations. Then all of a sudden, it's like, oh wait, they're 6-6 and they're going to a bowl game, and then they win the bowl game. I don't think it was necessarily because they were the most talented team, but I think it's because they played hard and they were disciplined. They knew what they were doing, and that allowed them to be competitive in games that they probably early in the season weren't projected to be.
And I think to an extent, like the thing that is going to be interesting to me is Barry Odom seems, and I don't know that there's a better word I can use. It's not probably what I actually mean, but he seems like a worrywart because anytime you hear him talk, he's like, man, we got to get deeper on the offensive line. We got to hit the portal hard. We got to do this. We got to do that. And I think sometimes fans can read into that and be like, okay, he knows we're going to be really bad. He could also just be like super planning ahead. Like I read the book, you know, I'm gonna like this on this podcast, but The Power of Negative Thinking, which is the book that Bob Knight wrote, right? Like how his process and thought process worked, and he was coaching at Indiana, and he thought of all the negative ways. So it wasn't, okay, yeah, we're a 75% free throw shooting team. It was, how can that 25% that we missed beat us? And how can we plan around that? So it makes me wonder if, like, does Barry Odom, like, okay, maybe we have a good offensive line, but maybe we have a weak link on, at right guard or whatever. We got to go in and get two right guards. Portal. So it's just kind of that sort of thinking to me, where word I want to use. But there are he's awfully cautious with his wording. He's cautious. He doesn't get overly optimistic. And so to me, it makes me wonder, like, okay, are there really some concerns at these position groups? Is it really going to take a lot of time? Or is it just not up to where he thinks it's going to be championship level, but they're going to be pretty good?
Right.
And I just think, again, with so many players, like if you returned last year's, this is going to sound crazy. I feel like if you returned last year's roster, I would look at the schedule and say, I think they're going to win 5 games. Because in Ryan Walters' first year, they won 4 games and were super competitive. Like there was 1 or 2 games they got really blown out of. I don't know what happened. So I don't know. I just expect a more competitive product this year. Whether or not that results in wins, I don't know. But I think that at the end of the season, I think Purdue fans are going to be happy with the direction the program is heading.
That's refreshing. I
I'll
don't think
take
I've left
that.
that
And
many. I don't think I've left that many games that early in my life. In all the years I've all the years I've gone to or yeah gone to Purdue games, I don't think I've ever left that many home games early. Or if it was a road game, just kind of got on with my afternoon or evening
Right.
by like the third quarter. So it's like okay, well, cool.
And the power of negative Hank, and I thought that was Twitter.
That's also accurate. Yep.
Twitter adjacent.
No, but just kind of one last thing, and then we'll kind of switch gears. But to your point, like the schedule this year, and when we kind of broke it down, and it didn't really hit me until we kind of looked at it, like they better win some games early
Yeah.
because November is murderers row. So I think to both your guys's points, like it's going to be so vital getting off to that start, not only just to build some momentum and just kind of build some positivity just around the program, but because come November, man, that when I think it's Michigan, Ohio State, one other game, and then
Northwestern and then IU. Excuse me,
IU.
Washington and then IU. And that Washington game, when Ben and I were going over the schedule, I pointed that one out because Ryan Walters is the defensive coordinator for Washington. So that's a
Right.
game where even if Washington isn't great, I believe it's in Washington, that is a game where
West
you
Coast
galvanize that
games.
locker room the right way, and they will go out and they'll play on his behalf, and they can that can be their game where they have that spirited effort where we're like, I'm talking about like where you just come out and if they play with a higher level of effort, can find yourself in trouble there. You look at that again, and you look at it, and like, oh, okay, well, we're just playing Washington. We just got off of, Michigan and Ohio State. This one should be easier. No, and then you get dumped on again. Please don't let
I
that be the
think
case.
I'll end on this. I think what's going to be interesting, one of the first games, I don't know if it was the first home game he attended, but one of the first games Barry Odom attended was the Purdue Indiana basketball game at Mackey Arena, and he took his recruits to that game. I'm not saying Purdue's going to beat Indiana at home. I don't know what Indiana's going to look like. I do think he's going to put a major emphasis on performing at that in that game. Considering you've got that entire weekend, there's going to be a Purdue basketball game, men's basketball game earlier that day. On the women's sports side, the volleyball team's going to host Indiana on Saturday. I think he's already referred to him as that team wearing red. I think Barry Odom is going to take that game very personally, and that's going to be a point of emphasis throughout this season, is my gauge on that. Now, again, I don't know what Indiana's going to look like, don't know what Purdue's going to look like. I would be shocked if it looks like 66-0 again. I think that's going to be a really intense, fun football game.
There are not enough playhards in the world if there's a 66-0 game. But Dustin, let's switch gears a little bit, man. And you got the chance to go to Mackey yesterday. And I'll tell you guys what, man, going through Twitter and seeing all the stuff from practice yesterday, I felt like an addict, man, because I was like, give me all the pictures, give me videos, give me interviews, give me everything I can get my hands on. And so, kind of just want to touch on that some because this probably obviously like the lead in before the Final Four year, there was a lot of hype and a lot of excitement leading up to it. And this to me kind of already feels more excitement, more hype. And I think Dustin, you even talked about it in your most recent story about how like national championship is even being thrown around. And I we talked about it on a previous pod about how, like, I think as fans we kind of take for granted almost that, like, we're like number one in the country, one or two by basically every media outlet out there. And, you know, 5, 10 years ago, that's insane to think about. And now it's kind of like, all right, well, let's just get to it. Like, but kind of what was the vibe like at Mackey? And we'll kind of go through like individual players here in a sec, but just kind of like the general vibe being back on the hardwood there.
So we don't get to see, I haven't seen a ton of practices. So, it's kind of hard to gauge how it compares to a regular, practice 10 or 12 or whatever fall practice.
Right.
But for the first practice of the season, it seemed very intense. Guys were locked in. There was a play, they were doing a scrimmage, double points or second turnover for a team ends the game. You had Trey Kaufman Wran and Daniel Jacobson on the floor, diving for loose balls. Braden Smith was active in the passing lanes. Like, there's no, if I can say this, there's no half-assing it. Like, those guys were full go the entire 2 hours of practice.
Oh yeah, you can cuss on
The
here. Yeah,
yeah,
you can cuss.
the vibe, and then afterwards we talked, with Trey, with Braden, and with Fletcher, and all three of them mentioned national championship, bringing a title back to Purdue. And so they know what the focus is. They all are trying to, as good as those three kids are, they're all trying to improve and to fix up some, like, and I thought it was interesting, I don't know that anybody asked Braden where he needs to improve, what the next evolution is. I think his answer to that was something along the lines of, getting some of the younger guys caught up, the new guys caught up, Oscar, Omer, Liam, Antoine, getting those caught up so that they can contribute if they need to, or not if they need to. A couple of those guys are going to contribute immediately. And Fletcher said, I got to be a better defensive player. It's not my lack of ability, it's my focus, and it's not getting beat on simple things. And so I want to be able to be, I don't want to get pulled out in the final 2 minutes if we're going offense defense. I want to be, I want to
Be
be an
in
asset on the floor
right.
both times. Trey Kaufman Wran said it's consistency with my jump shots. I want to be more, and that guy was clutch in a lot of situations last year, and a 60% shooter and one of the best big men in the country. So I think it's easy to just say I can get better at everything, but the fact that they had specific things that they wanted to improve on. So they know the pressure, they know the stakes are high, but they almost don't seem fazed by it. And I think going to the Final Four in 2024 kind of, changed their mind. They know what the pressure's like, they know how to handle those situations. And now they got the reinforcements to do what they wanted to do a year ago.
Yeah, no, Ben. Yeah, Ben and I talked about after when some of the portal moves happened about how it was hard to contain the excitement because you did feel like we got better in the areas that we needed to in terms of, like you said, the reinforcements. And yeah, I look at you look at Fletch, Braden, and TKR, and you know that they still it's still probably very fresh on their minds of making that national championship run and knowing now like okay, look, with the guys we have, we can do this. And so like yeah, like I think the first time you go through it, there can be a bit of like it's unknown territory. So I'm sure like, even from the point I'd say arguably like the Elite Eight on, where it's just kind of like, okay, like you're kind of playing, you're trying to subdue nerves in those situations. It's the first time you've been there. But this year I think they're in the same situation that I think that, that Mason and Zach were in, on that team a couple years ago where they knew like, no, we have one thing on our mind. It's national championship. That's it. Like, that's what we want. We believe we're good enough to do it. And so I imagine that their focus is kind of mirroring that what that was a couple years ago. Because and that team a couple years ago, what are they were sophomores. So they're like, all right, like, yeah, you're like, yeah, we're good. But like, you just and Trey was definitely he didn't have the role he has now. Braden didn't. I mean, he was still obviously improving. Fletch himself, and like you said, I think the fact that they're pointing out specifics, especially Fletcher in terms of defense, because I had some words about that last year. So I'm glad that he's aware of that. Because yeah, that is important, man, to be able to have a guy of his size and to be able to where you don't have to make those substitutions, offense, defense. Because sometimes in those late game situations, you don't get a dead ball, so you don't have the opportunity to get a guy back in. And so it's like, well, nah, you want to go with your seniors, your trusted hands. Those are the guys who you want on the floor. But obviously, we all know with Paint, if you can't defend, he will not play you at the hours that that it's necessary. Like in those key moments, he will pull somebody. And I don't think he gives a shit if you're a freshman or if you're a fifth or sixth year senior. He doesn't care. If you don't do it right, he's not gonna play. So, yeah.
Yeah, 100%.
And
Yeah.
I was just gonna say, like, the one thing that really jumped out to me with Braden too, like one thing I think, and I don't want to say improve because obviously, like, he's the best guard in the country. He sets a record every game. But I think, Dustin, I can't remember if it was your video or one of the videos from the highlights I saw, and Braden is driving and just kind of throws it up, and Daniel catches it real easy and lays it in. And like that play stood out. Like that's something that we just missed so much last year. And kind of Braden kind of, I think, got stuck sometimes making a play harder than it was because he really didn't have a big to throw it up to. Like Trey's a great big, but he's more of your back to the basket big. He didn't have a guy who you can throw it up to and go get it. And man, the first play I see Daniel dive and Braden lobs it up there. And I'm like, man, Braden could legit get 100 assists next year just on that play. Like that, I think, is one thing that's going to help Braden out a lot.
Yeah, that's that was a frequency. That was something that happened a lot during that practice, were those lobs of Daniel Jacobson. And Matt Painter even said in a podcast or a show or whatever he was on, basically, we love Daniel's, not just his rim protection and his shot blocking ability, but what he provides us in terms of a lob threat. And you saw that a lot. And what's interesting is Daniel still, he was getting back into the groove of it because he basically, it had been a couple months since he had really practiced with this team. And he's also put on 30 plus pounds. And so he's trying to, learn how to play with his
In his
weight.
body, right?
Yeah. And what I'll tell you is there was some inconsistency there, but not in a bad way. It's like, okay, he misses a shot at the rim or maybe doesn't grab a rebound, but you can tell it's because he hadn't played in a while. There were other times when he caught the ball at the free throw line, took one dribble and hammered it down. Like it was a thing of beauty. Right. And so I'm sorry I didn't get that on video, but we all in the media section were just like turning our
Oh.
heads, looking with like a big, eyebrows raised. Like, did we just see what we saw? Like,
Right.
it was impressive stuff. So I think he's got to get back. And I think just the summer and the fact he's also going to go to Colorado Springs to try out for the U19
U18.
national team. So getting that experience and potentially playing in competitive basketball overseas, I think we'll also catch him up to speed, kind of knock off some of the rust before the 25-26 season tips off. But yeah, I think in terms of everybody's going to look to Daniel Jacobson and be like, yeah, we need him for defense, we need him for rebounding. But the lob threat, I think, is a huge factor. And I don't disagree, Ben. I think that you could probably see Braden Smith get a lot of assists just on that one play. And he's not going to be, I think one of the problems too, before he put on that weight was he could potentially get knocked around down in the post. I don't think that's going to be the case. It may happen if with a bigger body, but he's not going to get beaten up like I don't even want to say he would have last year, but he would have struggled with endurance playing that physical level throughout the course of the game. I don't know that that's going to be an issue for him this season, especially when you have Oscar Clough, you can rotate him in. So it's not like he's going to have to play 35 minutes like Zach Edey did. He might play 22 and stay fresh the entire game.
It'd be huge.
It's gonna be the
The other
return of just
thing,
tall.
that caught my eye just kind of looking through some of your stories, and if anybody hasn't seen it, be sure to check out all of Dustin's recaps on Sports Illustrated. But it seemed to me Antoine West Jr. really stuck out, and he's a guy kind of flying under the radar, and we talked about this a little bit. It's a good problem to have if you're Painter, but I wonder kind of where he plays next year. It's almost kind of like Benter last year, where like I don't think like Jack had to redshirt, but Jack wasn't going to get minutes last year, so he didn't want to waste that year. And I almost wonder if that's kind of the same boat that Antoine might be in. But it sounds like, maybe at least, after day one, he kind of might be making that decision really tough, especially offensively.
That's going to be it's going to be a tough decision. Now, the first thing I'll tell you about Antoine West is you look at him and you're like, oh, grown man. That's not an 18-year-old. That's a grown man. Like, he is filled out. He is every bit 6'3", 180. He is a tough physical player. Early on, he kind of had some of those jitters. His jump shot was a little off, and you're kind of like, okay. But I don't know, 20 minutes into practice, he got comfortable and he could not, he was shooting the cover off the basketball. I think it's going to be interesting because Jack Benner did turn some heads last year during practice. It was just, where's he going to fit in terms of the minutes? So I could see this being a similar situation where it's like, yeah, could Antoine West give you something this year? Yes, he could. Is it going to be more beneficial for him in the long run to maybe redshirt this season when you're going to have Liam Murphy's going to be gone? Braden Smith's going to be gone. Fletcher Lawyer's going to be gone. Trey Cobb, there's going to be more opportunities for him to potentially
Minutes,
start
right?
or even come
Role.
off the bench and have a better role. So I don't know. I think he would push CJ Cox and Jakari Harris for minutes. I just don't know if there's going to be enough minutes to go around. Like, right, like Payne always says, I've got 200 minutes. I can't give everybody, 20.
Right.
So it'll be interesting to see what that situation is. The other one too is going to be Rollie Burgess, who's coming off surgery. To me, with that loaded front court with Daniel Jake, and I'm going off topic here, but Daniel Jacobson, Oscar Clough, Trey Coppin-Wren, and then Liam Murphy. And I've been told, well, not I've been told, we were told that maybe Jack Benner could play a little bit of the four, even at 6'5". I don't know that Rollie Burgess redshirting is out of the question. I could see Antoine West and Rollie Burgess both redshirting this season simply because of the minutes and because there just isn't space to get them on the court. I don't know. Antoine West, of the guys most likely to play, of those two, I would say Antoine West is, but you never know. Like I said, like Jack Benner turned some heads and was really impressive last season. There just wasn't enough space for him. And I wonder if Antoine West is going to run into that situation too, because I do think Jack Benner, it may be 8 to 10 minutes a game, but I think he'll find some floor time this year.
Do you think that last year, that if Jacobson doesn't get hurt, that Burgess redshirts?
Oh, well, he had made the decision before the season he wasn't going to.
Okay.
So I think he could have made the problem with Rollie Burgess wasn't his skill level, it was his conditioning. And I'm always hesitant to say that because those guys are all in way better shape than I am. But he, he would play two, he would come in and play 90 seconds and be really good. But then you could just see him wear down and he wasn't jumping as much and he was giving up rebounds and he was kind of a liability on defense. So his was his conditioning. I think if he was in better condition, I think he had the skill level to probably play more minutes. Matt Painter just kind of knew what his limit was. And that
Right.
was, I can get 6 minutes out of this guy in about two or three, let's say, I want to say this, 3 2-minute stretches or 2 3-minute stretches, and that's about it, right? So I think he still would have played, but I don't know, maybe it would have looked a little bit different.
In fairness to him, he was coming off an injury too, as well, I
I was gonna say
think, wasn't he?
he's got the shin deal now. Like he had surgery
Yeah.
on his
No, but
on the shin.
I thought even before last year
Oh, come out
he
of high
had a
school? I
knee,
think, yeah, I think
he
he
had
had
a
something.
knee injury or something, which kind of limited it. Just one more thing I wanted to ask you, kind of as I was reading through your story, it kind of was interesting that there was no mention of Jakari or CJ on there. And I think those are two guys who, at least, this him and I are both really excited to kind of see. They always say you take the biggest leap from your freshman year to your sophomore year. I think there's an opportunity for one of those guys to, I think, will start at the two, starting off the year. Just kind of curious how they looked. And kind of what your initial reactions were with those two.
Yeah, I was hesitant, and this is not a knock against them because it's the first day of practice, so I'm not going to take too much away from it. Some of Shikari's shots were off. His three ball wasn't falling at a high clip, at least from what I saw. Now, there were times when I was down with the bigs, and he might have been doing stuff with the guards, and he looked phenomenal. I don't know, but in what I
Right.
saw, the short little bit I saw, he was kind of struggling to find a shot. I can tell you that, and CJ Cox was just CJ Cox. Right, like he's a really good defender and he can shoot lights out. So
Yeah.
I didn't know if there was anything really to add there that I saw from his game. And again, it's an abbreviated practice. They're not going through sets. They're doing what Matt Painter called a glorified scrimmage. So you're not going to take too much away from it. So I didn't want to put in that story anything negative, really. And I felt like if I said, Jakari Harris and CJ Cox were the same players we saw, I felt like that would come off negatively. And I don't mean it in
Yeah.
a bad way. It's just like some of these other guys you noticed. And some of it's the fact that we didn't see Jack Benner play last year. We
Right.
didn't know what to expect with Antoine West. And so I wanted to highlight those guys because I feel like in practice 6 or 7, Jakari's going to look just fine, maybe add some elements to his game. CJ's going to look just fine, add some elements to their game. They were both high energy. They were both, what I can tell you is they were very locked in defensively. Everybody on the court was locked in defensively. So there are still some communication issues, but I think those are going to get worked out over time. But yeah, it wasn't me omitting them was not a knock to them. It was just, I think I picked up more from some of those other guys and things around and I'll be curious to see where their game's at maybe later this summer if we get a chance to go see them practice again when they've had, 6 or 7 practices under the belt and see kind of what it looks like now that they've kicked the rust off after they've been off for a month.
Yeah, I
That's
think
exciting.
I felt like with especially with Jakari last year, I think it was like the West Coast swing. I felt like we saw the game slow down for him, because that's always kind of like my concern when when true freshmen get to play, and really just, well, freshmen, newcomers, whatever, is that like what like the speed when you go from high school to college, obviously it's going to be different. And like there were times where you'll see a guy and he's very much so rushing. Like sometimes guys will get like stupid like travel turnovers, like they'll get called for a travel simply because like their brain's just moving, their body's moving faster than their brain is. But I felt like as we got later into the season, you were seeing Jakari and CJ. I mean, CJ was just picking people up 94 feet because he's like, yeah, like why not? But Jakari in particular, I recall like just really seeing like, okay, I think the game is slowing down for him. Like I think that he's starting to process stuff. There were times where get the ball and he'd be open. There's a guy coming to him and he knows, okay, look, I could pump fake and then get my shot off. Whereas early in the season, he probably would have tried to rush up a shot. It doesn't hit. So yeah, I understand where you're coming from that standpoint. I think, but like just like what Ben said, where I think those are just two guys we all know because we saw them last year. It's like, well, did they get better? And it might not be something where it's like, oh, well, you don't necessarily see it in practice one, practice two. I know for me, I'll care once the season starts. Like, what? Well, show me then. That's really how I feel. But yeah, I'm glad that you were able to kind of expand on that a bit. 'Cause yeah, I was kind of curious myself as to like, wait, like, what's going on with them?
Well, the one thing I'll say too, the one, and I'll kind of end on this too, is I think it's important to remember that I don't. At least from my perspective, Jakari Harris, his game coming to Purdue was not catch and shoot. And that's kind of what they need him to do with Braden Smith having the ball in his hand so much. Now, he can be a secondary ball handler and he can create, but I think he's more accustomed to getting to his pull up, driving to the basket, as opposed to when I saw a lot of those misses, it was, we're going to, get the ball down the floor quickly and we need you to shoot the three. And I think he's still developing that catch and shoot. When he gets more comfortable with that, if he can get, I think he was 32%, but if that's a guy that can get up to 37%, like with the other shooters you have around this team, with Liam Murphy and Fletcher Lawyer, CJ, all Braden, all hovering around 40%, they'll be in really good shape. And I think he probably will make that leap. It's just, again, some of the times the first day rust, it's some noticeable in some players more than others. And that's, like, again, it wasn't a negative thing. It was just, I saw differences or improvements or players we hadn't seen in a while or ever, I thought it was worth highlighting that more than some of the other
That
things.
makes sense.
I
That
hope you
makes
get to
sense.
go.
All right.
Hope you guys get to go back to a practice when what is it? Omer and and
Yeah, Oscar.
Oscar are back, because I think that would be some really interesting stuff to see. Because I think that'll probably be the first opportunity to really see, okay, what could this possibly like look like, when the live bullets are flying. So that'll be very interesting to me, man. I there's yeah those are two where I'm like, man, like if that clicks, yeah, that's when it gets really scary.
And Trey made, I don't know if you saw the video, but Trey made a comment like somebody compared him to, Matt Painter told Trey that Oscar Clough rebounded at a higher rate. I don't know what that measurement is specifically, but at a higher rate than Zach Edey. And PJ Thompson told him that Omer Meyer was basically Braden Smith, but taller. And Trey goes, if that's the case, I don't know how we're going to lose a game. So, I mean, he said that in jest, right? Because it's hard to go through a college basketball season undefeated. But there's a lot of confidence in what's coming to West Lafayette, even though those two guys aren't on campus yet.
You see the highlights of Omer are like, yeah, that one I saw that. I mean, obviously I'm short myself, so like I was always playing guard positions in basketball, but like, yeah, you see in terms of his vision on the court, his ability to get to his mid-range, to me, I'm seeing that and I'm like, oh yeah, this can get beautiful real quick. And then you see Oscar in terms of his ability to be able to play back to the basket, his post game, obviously rebounding, and he even has the capability to be able to step outside and shoot from three. So I remember after Edie, everyone was all, oh, he's just tall, he's not an athlete. Now he's off in the NBA, actually splashing threes and becoming, first team all rookie. So I'm like, Oscar, if you rebound better than Big Zach, you know what I'm saying? Like, let's turn this up.
Don't forget about Liam either, man.
It's
Don't
true.
forget about Liam.
And I th that's why I think too, the what you said about Jakari in terms of if he can get better with his 3-point shooting. Like, I think the year they went to the national championship game, I want to say Lance Jones shot like 37, 38% from three, which like obviously like everyone knows you get to 40%, you're considered like really like a knockdown sniper shooter. But like to be able to shoot upwards to 40 is still relevant in terms of schematically, because it's another guy who the defense has to be aware of. Like, look, he will willingly shoot, and he's capable. I think there's been Purdue teams over the years where you've even the best lineup has still had one guy who you just kind of knew like is probably not going to shoot, or he's not a threat from outside. I think that was kind of some of the things last year too, when you had like when I'm not trying to like shit on him, but like when you had Caleb out there, is you knew like you weren't necessarily having to worry about him on the offensive end. It kind of makes it a little bit easier to handle offensive, I mean defensively. So yeah, I mean, if Jakari's able to, like you said, if he's able to kind of get better at that, the spot up shooting where you get it and just catch it, no dribble into type stuff. Again, yeah, that's another piece that can just make the overall flow of what Purdue does. It can make it a lot easier.
Yeah, absolutely. I couldn't agree more. If you can, Liam Murphy was a 40 some percent, 40 Four and Fletcher was 42 and Braden was 39. So Omer's gonna be up in probably the high 30s. Like they've got plenty of shooters. So
Ready.
if you can add that to your bag and you got to keep defenses honest and keep them in check, it's gonna be lethal.
Shooting like me out there,
Well,
yo.
I don't know. We will just leave that one alone. I'm really excited. I can't wait to see kind of what happens this year. And can't wait to see kind of more of practices and everything leading up to this season, Dustin. So thank you for kind of giving us fans insight there. Let us know where fans can get that insight and where they can kind of find all of your Boilermaker knowledge there.
So if you want to follow me on Twitter, it is at Shooty Dustin. So at SCHUTTEDUSTIN. If you want to read our content, it's Purdue Boilermakers on SI. So it's SI.com/college/Purdue. And then I've also opened up, started my own YouTube page, which is about, I don't know, 3 or 4 weeks old. And it's just if you type in my name, Dustin Shooty, you see me in a picture of me standing on Mackey. Just click on that, check out some videos, give it a like, subscribe if you'd like. But that's where you can find all the stuff I've been posting, whether it's written or video.
Excellent. Yeah, I'm on your page right now for SI.com, and there's a good deal of content on here. So yeah, there's definitely a way if midday at work you just want to like not work, there's some good content on there you can get in there and check all of that out.
And one thing I've always appreciated too is like we try to talk about some of the other sports too, whether it's volleyball, women's hoops, baseball, and you do a really good job kind of making sure to highlight those as well. So for anybody who kind of wants to see, some of the other sports outside of basketball and football there, make sure to check out Dustin's stuff because he makes sure to hit all of that. So
It does.
kudos on there as well, sir.
Thank you. Yep, we're trying to give more coverage to women's basketball and volleyball, and we did some softball and baseball stuff in the spring. So, we cover as much as we can, or as I should say, it's just me right now. So I cover as much as I can. So,
Right.
hopefully, I can fill the needs and keep people informed and entertained.
I have a question. Since you mentioned women's basketball, kind of what are your thoughts about the state of the program right now? And they brought back Katie Gerald's last year. Obviously, it was a very rough year. I mean, just kind of your early thoughts. Do you think that they will be better than they were last year? Do you think that they've kind of made some? They've made some strides in the right direction. I know, obviously, I think it's much like basketball and like we talked about with football, where even what you've seen now, you don't know what the actual like final product is going to be, but just kind of based on what you might have seen last year versus now, kind of what's your thoughts?
Yeah, I think they're going to be better. Because they have now with Avery Gordon coming in, she's 6'7", right? So she's as tall as Lauren Betts at UCLA. They have Kendall Puryear, who's 6'3", and then Lana McCarthy, who's 6'4". So they've got really good post players. And then on the perimeter, you bring in Kiki Smith, who was an Arkansas guard, and she was a national junior college national champion player of the year. They just got Sage Stahl out of Indiana State, and she was, I think, came off the bench and gave him 7.7 rebounds per game. And she had a double double against Purdue in Mackey Arena last year. They've added the SoCon. I can't remember now. I get two of these girls mixed up, and I can never remember what, because one of them went to UNC Greensboro, which I believe was Nia Smith, and the other one to UNC Wilmington, which was Taylor Henderson. If I'm not correct, they're mixed up on the schools. But one was the freshman player of the year. One was this all conference player. And the one I'm really excited about is Taylor Feldman. And if you know your Purdue women's basketball, the comparison I got from Coach Katie Gerald herself was basically she's Abby Ellis, but taller. And Abby Ellis was a really good ball handler, a really good scorer. This Taylor is also a player at Northern Arizona who was an all-conference player. And then she started her career as a freshman 16% from 3-point. And I believe last year she was shooting 36%. So she can take that next, like they have a really good interior, and then she's built some depth on the front lines, and then she surrounded it with shooting. So I don't know if they're going to play the up and down style that they want, but it's going to be interesting to me because I think their roster makeup and the way that they complement each other is a lot better than what they had last season. The other problem with last season was that they dealt with so many injuries and illness, and the schedule was so brutal that they really
Yeah,
had no
schedule is
time to get
rough.
any, they had no time to get any momentum. So
Right.
the staff knows
No.
that it wasn't a good year, that it was a rebuilding process. And I think they're a little bit more confident in the pieces they have. Now, obviously we'll see, I'm sure they'll start practice here soon. I don't have a specific date on that one, but I am more optimistic that they're going to be, I think they're going to be a lot better. And I don't know that that results in an NCAA tournament appearance, but I think they're going to be competitive in the Big Ten. I think they're going to have a postseason. I think they'll have a postseason, and I'll be surprised if they're not on the plus side of the 500 mark this year.
That's good. Well, yeah, I think they're kind of in the same boat as football was, where like it's just look, you need to see a competitive product out there, because there were games where you would see for a quarter, it's like, okay, like yeah, we might have something here, and they just get blown out from there. And it felt like Ben and I would talk last year about how like it just seemed like every game they won, they either got hot from shooting, like hot, like their shooting either was really good, like they got hot, or they had to win it ugly. had Win It Ugly, like a
Yeah.
low scoring affair. And so, yeah, obviously having that post presence allows you to be able to slow down the game. You surround that with shooters, though, you're setting yourself up a nice little recipe there in terms of having being able to play win games multiple ways offensively. So yeah, I think we all want, especially for if we're a fan of Katie Gerald, you want just from that standpoint, you want her to be successful. So yeah, I think the biggest thing for them, while obviously you want them to be better for wins and losses, I think they aesthetically, from the eye test, they need to, if they
Yeah.
look competitive, that'll mean a lot.
Right. I agree, and I think that will be the case, but we got a couple months, we'll see.
Correct.
And hopefully that's the case because I know a lot of people want that program to be successful and kind of get back in the direction of being a national power again.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Definitely. Well, Dustin, we really enjoyed it, man. I appreciate your insight and kind of giving us hope for the year ahead, both on the gridiron and at Mackey there. So really appreciate it. Keep doing the really good write-ups. Really enjoy that. So thank you again. And man, you're welcome back anytime. We really enjoyed it.
Yeah, for sure.
Thank you guys. I really appreciate it. And yeah, we'll do it again sometime. That for
Yes,
sure.
sir. I would definitely love that. We love that. Yeah, for sure.
Definitely. All right. Well, th th thank you very much. And most importantly, boiler up.
Yes, sir.